Good afternoon, class. It is now 1 o'clock and we are going to start our lesson. We are going to pick up where we left off.
We got a review.
A review?
What was the last thing we talked?
The last thing we talked about was the opportunities of World War I.
Opportunity to do what?
I'm going to read it.
Genocide.
Oh, I see it. Genocide of the 20th century. Young men were shot, women, children, elderly marched out into deserts to die. All properties confiscated by the state. And the estimated...
Your glasses?
They broke. It's estimated 1.2 million Armenians. There we go. Armenians. 500,000 Assyrians and 200,000 Greeks died because of this genocide. The Ottoman Empire completely collapsed during World War I. The Empire knocked out of war in September of 1918. The Ottoman was knocked out. Then in 1919, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk leads Turkish nationalist movement. Good afternoon. Yes. They were knocked out in September of 1918.
Like what day,
I don't know the day specifically, but it was in September. The Atatürk would serve as Republic of Turkey's first president and would commit to secularization.
Secularization
of Turkey. What does that mean? Does anybody know what that means?
Secularization. Secular. What does that refer to?
Secular, S-E-C-U-L-A-R?
No, S-E-C-U-L-A-R. One C, not two.
I said two. And it has like something to do with nationalism.
No.
It's the separation between church and state.
Mm. All right. So remember. The Turks were trying to impose a religious state. Well, Atatürk comes in and he removes the religion. And so he's going to make it a secular state. So it's more like a modern Western country, right? That's what you meant to say, bro?
Yeah, that is exactly what I meant to say. Good thing you are here to help, to assist.
You might get voted off the island.
I might. Raise your hand if you want me to stay. That tells me what I need to know. Professor, you could take over.
Oh, so I can resume the mantle of authority.
Yeah, they don't like me.
Hey, that's fine. See, what I do is not easy,
no,
my friends.
Not.
It is not easy. All right. So, ultimately, as we know, the Ottomans joined the Central Powers. Their war effort ended up being stymied as the war went on. And we don't have time to get into it, but one of the biggest reasons why was England would actually spark revolutions of sorts in the empire by encouraging Arabs in particular to rise up and resist, because the Arabs were a different race than the Turks. The Ottomans were committed to imposing Turkish nationalism, the Turkish language, the Turkish culture, which was something the Arabs did not agree with. So in the end, the Ottoman Empire fell. They signed an armistice and they were knocked out of the war. In the following year, the empire would continue to experience problems. It would be fractured. And in the end, that's what caused Atatürk to rise. And what they did was essentially dissolve the empire. So at its height, the Ottoman Empire was all this that was in red. But what Ataturk and the revolutionaries decided to do was essentially to just remove Turkey from the empire and make the Republic of Turkey. That could be a Turkish nationalist state. The rest of the empire, as you can see here, either broke away and became independent countries or would be occupied by European powers. Of course, ironically, one of the reasons why what is going on in the Middle East today is going on goes back to this point. Because much of the Middle East would either be controlled by the British or it would be controlled by the French. And when they gave back independence, they only created animosity, particularly between the Jews, who eventually would take over land in what then was a province of the Ottoman Empire, and the people who were there, the Palestinians. But that was part of new imperialism. But this empire that had been in place for hundreds of years simply ceased to be. And the dynasty that traced its lineage back to Uthman in his dream was over. Was over. Questions? So, we saw what they did to Africa. We know what they did to the Middle East. Well, let's spin the globe and see what ended up happening in Asia. Well, long story short, as the 17th century gave rise to the 18th century, which is the 1700s, and as the 1700s gave way to the 1800s, the Europeans began slowly pushing more and more into the Asian trade network. The most successful of them all was the British. They would manage to take control, as we talked about, by making deals with local rajas. They would, in the end, would take over all of modern India, Pakistan, parts of Afghanistan, as well as Burma and other places. But of course, there were other European powers doing the same thing. But the Brits would, by the 1850s, 1900-ish, would control roughly 1/8 of all livable space on Earth and would have under their domain 1 out of every 10 human beings on Earth. And they wanted more. The heart of this empire, though, was India. India had a huge population, had vast quantities of natural resources, and was producing those resources to fuel Britain's industrialized economy. One of the biggest, most important crops was cotton. But there were other commodities that were utilized. Ironically, Britain also tapped the population and recruited sepoys, soldiers, that would serve in their armies. The funny thing is, when England launched the army into Egypt to take control of it, 95% of the soldiers actually came from India. Same thing when they started pushing into China. Yes, they had British officers, but they weren't English. And the Netherlands taking control of Indonesia, France pushing in and eventually taking control of Indochina, setting the seeds for one of my classes for next semester when I talk about the Vietnam War. All of that was going on. But notice what they're doing. They're pushing in, they're taking more and more control, but ultimately they're setting their sights on China. Why China?
It's weak and has commodities.
There you go. The Qing dynasty was in charge, and they were floundering. Had vast populations, had vast wealth, and if those could be exploited for profit, you're talking the motherlode of more, more, more. So, what the Brits began to do is use their strength in India as leverage to put pressure on China, because they didn't have to sail around the world with an army. They could raise military forces a few hundred miles away. And to be redundant, the Qing are in decline, we talked about that. But they also started making mistakes. And amongst the biggest mistakes that they made was willful ignorance. They viewed the Europeans as just another group of barbarians. And of course, in the Chinese mindset, barbarians was anyone who was not Chinese. The Chinese assumed that if they ignored the Europeans, they'd go away. And if they didn't go away, well, then they would have to beg for favors. Either way, China wins. Why? Because that is what it had always happened before. But the mistake that they made was not understanding that European civilization was equal to Chinese civilization in its complexity. Plus, Europe was advancing scientifically, intellectually, militaristically. That offset the population differences. 400 million people in China in the 19th century versus 7 million Britons. So, even though there was less of them, the British had more actual strength that they could use. But to penetrate China, England had to get around the Canton system. Anyone remember what the Canton system was? So you could not, if you were English or Dutch or French, go and do business inside China. You had to go where they told you to, an isolated island in a harbor. You were only allowed to bring in what the Chinese let you bring in, because your ship was inspected when you sailed into harbor. You then could buy or trade with people who brought the goods to the island. So China controlled what you could buy from them. So not only are they controlling what you're bringing in, they're controlling what you're taking out. And at the end of the day, China was trying to maintain a favorable balance of trade. They wanted to sell you stuff that cost them nothing for high prices. Plus the laws of China. If a European was found inside China, they could be executed on sight. So, the Qing, in their ignorance, believed, well, this is how we've done it for hundreds of years. We've always been able to keep people at arm's length. This is going to be no different. But they made a mistake. The Chinese believed that they could control the flow and get what they wanted, which primarily was silver. But they missed out on something that was small, that outweighed its potential in gold.
Drugs.
Opium. Opium was grown in China for hundreds of years, but the opium that was grown in India was way more potent and way more addictive. In China, in the seedy parts of the cities, were things called opium dens, where men mostly would go after work and they would do a couple of puffs of opium and then sack out for an hour or two, and then they'd go home to their wives and their family. Well, British opium, if you took a hit, could knock you out for a day. And then the moment you came to again, you could taste it. You would obtain physical dependence on it, which means you needed another hit. But here's the funny thing. If you start smoking drugs and getting hooked on drugs and you're knocked out day after day after day, what are you not doing?
Working.
You're not working. You're not being productive. You're not contributing to the well-being of your family or society. So, China had actually made opium use illegal and banned its importation. Why? Simple. Because drugs are bad.
Okay.
But here's the thing. England didn't consider it to be drugs.
Rather,
England considered it a good, a commodity. No different than a bucket full of apples or a chest full of tea. It was just a commodity. So, England, which was practicing free trade, began demanding the right to sell anything as a usable commodity. But China started saying, no, 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 no. Look, this guy, look at him. Oh, dope. This guy can't even sit up. He's so hooked up on it. Bad, bad stuff.
Don't they still have those today?
They do. They do. Now, by the way, the best stats that are available suggest that in 1938, 1% of the Chinese population was addicted to opium. 1%. Very, very small, right? But what's 1% of 400 million? You can't do that math?
4 million.
4 million customers. You can make a lot of money selling something to 4 million customers that need it physically. Well, soon, through a black market, the British began smuggling in chests hidden in other commodities that they're bringing into Canton. And they're making deals with drug dealers that would come to the island and hide money in baskets of other things that are allowed to trade. And then in the factories, quietly, secretly, they would do drug deals. And then the opium would be smuggled into the mainland and then sold to the dens. Just like what the Mexican cartels are doing, bringing in fentanyl, which is made in China. Well, the problem is when you become addicted to any substance, you can't live without it and you're willing to pay anything for it. So within a matter of a few years, this lust from opium sees more silver pouring out of China than the British are bringing to buy Chinese goods. And the favorable balance of trade that China had maintained through the Canton system starts to shift in the advantage of the British. Well, here's the catch. The government would actually attempt to stop it, because it's in the government's interest to stop bad things from happening, particularly that hurt the economy. That, for example, is one of the reasons why Trump is pushing tariffs. Because all of the other countries on the earth use tariffs against us, and they don't buy our goods. Well, how is that fair?
Well, the Qing decided to take action against this thing that's crippling their society. 1% of their population hooked on drugs.
So what does the emperor do?
He empowers the governor of Canton, Lin Qishu,
to stop the drug flow. Now, by the way, Lin Qishu was a scholar gentry. He took the Confucian exams and passed on his first try.
He had a reputation that was well known
as being incorruptible. He was a law and order guy that believed in principle. And you could not knock him off of his principle.
If he was told by the emperor to do something, that's what he would do.
And his task was, get rid of the opium dealers. Stop allowing the smuggled goods to get through Canton. But here's the problem. Who's bringing the drugs in?
British.
Right, it's not like he can send a bunch of soldiers out into the countryside and arrest, you know, Chinese people. The problem is it's being smuggled in on ships, hidden. So what does he do? Well, he does the same thing that any adult that was given a task would attempt to do. Try to complete the task. Initially, he tried to negotiate with the British, trying to explain to them that this is just not right. You are bringing this horrible substance into our country, and it's having a detrimental effect on our nation. And it could threaten our economy, which would threaten our ability to trade with you. And the British were like, yeah, we're good. Ironically, Lin Qishu was so concerned about this, he would actually personally write a letter to the Queen of England, who at the time was Queen Victoria. And in his letter, he appealed to her as a Christian woman, essentially claiming, would Jesus allow his flock to ensnare another group of people with narcotics? I don't know anywhere in Scripture where it says Jesus would be okay with that.
But apparently when the letter got over to London and all of her officials read it, they were not going to let the Queen read it. They actually destroyed the letter.
So, after being rebuffed, after day, attempt after attempt after attempt, he finally said, fine. He decided to take action.
He began bringing in his soldiers and blockading the European warehouses. He also began positioning Chinese ships into the harbor to stop the Europeans from even getting to shore and demanding the right to come in and inspect them while they were still in the water. He also unleashed his soldiers and they began going through the factories, the warehouses.
Merchants who were in the buildings, both Chinese and British, if they were caught in possession, would be arrested. Of course, if they were British, they were put under house arrest.
And, most significantly, they began confiscating these illegal commodities.
Over 1,200 tons of opium would be seized and burned.
Well, here's the thing. Under British common law, they're not selling a drug. They're selling a good. So the Brits were outraged, to say the least.
They argued
Not only is Lin destroying private property, but the whole Canton system interferes with free trade.
When Lin persisted, the Brits then warned that if the Chinese don't stop this anti-opium campaign, we're going to have to send in our soldiers to protect our warehouses, our merchants, and our goods.
But Lin had an order, and he was determined to fulfill the order.
But unfortunately, this would result in a war. This war is the First Opium War.
Now this war, even though it technically lasts for 3 years, the war itself in terms of battles, it was actually brief. It was just the state of war that lasted this long.
And why did it last? Well, England would unleash its full military capacity. Ultimately, the cause of the war was when England issued an ultimatum. They demanded that the Qing pay damages for all of the commodities that had been burned.
Well, here's an interesting analogy. If you are in possession of a bag of cocaine and I steal it from you, can you sue me?
No.
Why not?
Place.
Yeah, you don't have a right to possess it to begin with. So England's saying that China has to pay for the damage of the property. You know what China's response was?
It's illegal.
It's illegal. It's not a good. It's not a legitimate good. We're not paying you anything.
Well, the Brits were not pleased.
So they tried deploying their ships, commonly referred to as junks, to stop the British ships. But as you can see, the Chinese junks were no match for modern ocean-going British naval vessels, ships of the line.
At every point, the British ships destroyed the Chinese junks. They sent 45 vessels plus 4 of the first steam-powered gunboats. Boom, 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 boom. Blowing up everything in their way. Then, once the Chinese fleet, if you could call it that, was shattered, the Brits then launched a 2-stage attack.
The first fleet would sail north and would penetrate the Yellow River, heading towards Nanjing and the winter capital, Winter Palace. That's where the emperor went during wintertime, and he was up in Beijing during the summer. So one fleet is going to penetrate here. The other fleet penetrates Canton Harbor.
The British ships would pound the ancient fortresses, some of which dated all the way back to the Ming period, that were built to hold off the pirates in the 14th and 1500s. The Brits then would occupy the cities of Canton and Shanghai. Then, from those bases, they landed British expeditionary forces, ground troops, and began marching towards important locations. And the Chinese couldn't stop them. 19,000 British soldiers, mostly sepoys, mostly from India, easily routed two Chinese armies, each over 100,000 strong. And how did they do it?
Brits had better weapons.
The Chinese mostly went into battle with swords and spears. They had a few old matchlock muskets, but they were more like primitive shotguns that hadn't been used in 200 years. So when they put the gunpowder in and they went click, many of them blew up in the hands of the soldiers. The Brits, on the other hand, they had flint lock, so it struck like a Zippo, smoothbore muskets.
Lethal at a distance up to 200 yards. Firing musket balls. Flying at subsonic speeds. That, unlike, say, if you were to get shot by a dreaded, 5.56 or 223, tiny little bullet which would cut through you like knife going through hot butter, these balls were lead. The heat and friction would cause them to splatter and warp, and then it would be like a lug hitting you in the chest, causing a huge hole and basically ripping out your back.
Assuming it'll hit you.
Well, yeah. Well, that's why they use firing lines. Because if they can put enough lead firing simultaneously downrange, they'll hit at least something.
Don't they have like a photo of that? Like, I think it's like a
There are all those artifacts that survived. But again, remember, ba-boom versus oh, and the British by this point were using pure iron artillery. They had moved around away from the bronze guns. Well, most of the Chinese guns, again, dated back to the Ming Dynasty. They were cast iron or cast bronze, hadn't been fired for hundreds of years, and you had a greater chance of the gun blowing up because it had been sitting there in the cold and the heat. And we all know what happens to metal. If it gets cold, and then it gets hot, and then it gets cold, and then it gets hot. It becomes brittle and eventually goes poof.
So in the end, the British just wiped the field of the Chinese.
But out of sheer luck, the expeditionary force that goes in the Yellow River actually stumbles upon an annual event dating back to the Song Dynasty, which was one of the major dynasties after the Han. We're talking 500 AD. Huge canals had been created throughout China. So if the canals were maintained, it was possible to sail almost anywhere in China through the river system. Took a long time, but they could move stuff. And one of the things that they did annually was they went around and they collected all of the taxes, and they put all the tax money on the barges, and they would sail the barges to the Emperor's palace. Well, the Brits are sailing upstream, and down comes these barges full of money. Guess what the Brits do?
Take the money.
Yoink. And by losing all of their tax revenue, what could the Chinese not do?
Pay their soldiers.
Pay their soldiers. And if you're a soldier and you see the enemy basically just carving through your buddies, and now you're told you're not gonna get paid, are you going to be willing to die?
No.
Nah, I'm good.
Yeah.
Later.
Now, interestingly enough, the moment the Brits seize the barges, the emperor does something that's unprecedented. The emperor at the time, Dao Guang, attempts to negotiate a peace deal with the Brits.
Because after all, the Brits had him by the
balls.
Yeah, you could say that. And the Brits said, fine.
So, in 1842, they would impose, and I use this, bless you, they would impose, so, bless you. So it really wasn't a fair negotiation. Rather, the British kind of told the Chinese, you're going to sign this document.
The Treaty of Nanking. 1842. This was the first of about 100 unequal treaties that the Europeans would impose upon the Chinese. And again, it's called unequal for a reason. It's kind of in the name, no? So, what are the terms? Simple. Term number one. China must open 5 ports to British trade. No more just Canton. 5 ports. And in those ports, they can establish consulates, government offices.
And guess what the consulates can do? Set the tariff prices that the British are going to be willing to pay to the Chinese. So the Brits are going to go in, 5 ports. They're going to put officials in those ports, and the officials, not the Chinese, are going to set the tariffs
for British goods. Did you get all those three? Term two. Missionaries are going to be allowed to enter China. Missionaries are going to be allowed in. By the way, could any European go into China before this?
No.
What would happen to them? They're going to get killed. Now guess what? Now we're going to let the priests in. And by the way, what have priests been doing for the last 200, 300 odd years whenever a European country entered another country? Besides spreading Christianity? Spying, engaged in espionage. Yeah. So, one, 5 ports, consulates, tariffs. 2, missionaries. 3, extraterritorial rights. Extraterritorial rights. Does anyone know what that means?
They get more land.
No. Good guess, but no.
They get access to resources?
No. Anyone else?
Extraterritorial rights. If somebody that's a British subject gets arrested in China, they are going to be charged under British law, not Chinese law. And they are going to be tried in British courts, not Chinese courts.
Well, that's term number 3.
What was term 2?
Missionaries?
Got 2 more for you.
Term number 4. Hong Kong turned over for the British.
Hong Kong would become a British protectorate? Yeah, I think it was a protectorate.
And by the way, Hong Kong would remain a British possession all the way up until December 31st, 1999. I remember when they had it on TV, when the British turned it over to China. Any of you paying attention to what has happened to Hong Kong in the last few years?
They are having a lot of protests against the government.
They are. And what's happening to the people who are protesting?
They're getting killed.
Yeah, they're being disappeared. I had a buddy that happened to be in Hong Kong during the COVID lockdowns. The police were out on the streets. They would shoot you if you left your apartment. Because everyone was required by the Chinese communists to stay in their homes. So people were starving to death in Hong Kong. It was up until... Yes. Yeah, Hong Kong got turned over to the British. By the way, when the British had it, it was one of the richest cities on earth because all British commerce went into Hong Kong throughout all of Asia. Term 95, money. Money. 21 million ounces of silver. 21 million ounces of silver. By the way, I'm not quite sure what the current market rate for silver is, but generally it runs about 22 bucks an ounce. So let me see, 22 times 21 with 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 zeros after it. In modern money, that's the equivalent of $462 million.
It said it would be worth about over $700 million today.
What?
Yeah, I just Googled it. It said, like, as of today, $21 million ounces of silver would be worth about $700 million.
What's the price of silver going at?
It's $34
and
what is it?
$34.50.
Oh, all right. So it's not 22. All right, I thought it was like in the 20s. But all right, that's fine. Yeah, okay. So we're talking a lot of money. And what is England getting paid for? The drugs that were burned. All right, well, here's the funny thing. Like chum, when you throw chum in the water, bloody chunk, cut up chunks of fish, what happens?
All the predators smell it and they come to it.
Exactly. So the moment word got out that England got this awesome deal with China, within months, the French show up, the Americans show up, and they demanded similar treaties under threat of military action. And the Chinese capitulated. But here's the catch. All of the treaties, all three that were made, Treaty of Nanking and the French and United States treaties, they were all set to expire in 1856. And guess what happened in 1856?
Another war.
Another war. We're not going to be able to get through all this, but we'll start it. By the way, the causes were similar. England was trying to push more opium into China, trying to get more Chinese hooked on drugs, just like the Chi Coms are doing today with fentanyl, trying to get American kids hooked on drugs. But truth be told, they got overly aggressive because they knew that the unequal treaties were going to expire. So they wanted another deal. What they began demanding, I hope I have it on here, and I don't, was a dead marker. That's what happens when you leave a marker and you don't put a cover on it. It dries out. What the British, the Americans, and the French demanded was most favorable nation status. Anyone ever heard this term before? Most. Wait, say that again?
Isn't it the
country will allow one nation to have more of a sphere of influence on a certain area of the country.
To what extent?
Like, they would have more, like, they'll allow, like, certain soldiers, they'll allow one country to have their soldiers in there, to have residents in there, almost be like...
Yeah. So essentially what you're doing is if a nation gives another nation most favorable nation status, that the people from the treaty nation that comes in essentially are equal to the people who live there. So a British company will be treated the same under the law as a Chinese company. A British citizen would be treated the same as a Chinese citizen. So what does this mean? The same right to go anywhere, freedom of movement, freedom of travel throughout the countryside, the same right to do business with anyone in the country, the same taxes, and so forth. This would have opened up all of China. And combined with the extraterritorial rights, this would mean essentially that the British subject or the French or the American could take a big satchel of drugs and bring it anywhere in China they wanted to. Oh, and because they would get equal status, the Chinese police would have to protect the drug dealer just as they would protect any other legitimate business. Including from acts of piracy. So this was huge pressure. And I'll give you the cause and we'll call it a class.
They're pushing. But they're waiting for an opportunity. They're waiting for a spark.
And the spark came when the Chinese seized a ship
that was registered as the HMS Arrow.
This picture is a picture of the arrow. If you look at it, you can see that what it is a Chinese junk.
This ship was used by pirates, captured by the Chinese, auctioned off and bought by a British company. The ship was registered and licensed in Hong Kong. But while the ship was out at sea, its registration expired. So it pulls into a Chinese port. It's flying the British flag, but the Chinese officials stop it. Because they're like, wait, since when do the British sail in junks? They stop the ship, they board the ship with Chinese Marines, and they arrest 12 of the crew members, who are all Chinese. Why? Well, the Chinese Marines allege that they're pirates. Because guess what pirates have a tendency to do?
Break the law.
They break the law, so they will put other countries' flags on their ships to get sanctuary.
Well, the British official in Hong Kong sends a stark warning. What are you doing? This is a British ship. These are our subjects, because under the laws of England, anybody who sails on a British ship is considered a British citizen. So, the British demand a release.
Oh, and coincidentally, they also demand an apology.
Because apparently, when the captain of the Chinese Marines got on board, he pulled down the British flag, dropped it on the ground, and stomped on it. Well, when the Chinese get the response, they go through the backgrounds of the 12 Chinese sailors that were arrested and realize three of them actually have warrants. So they release 9, they keep 3. And as for the insult, no, they're not going to give an apology.
Guess how the British would respond?
Who are you?
We'll find out on Friday.
Have a happy Halloween tomorrow. And hopefully you don't engage in too much shenanigans.
And just remember, if you eat too much candy, your bellies will be sore.